Lecture 20, The Classical Period of Chinese Buddhism.
In the last lecture, we talked about the challenges and opportunities faced by the first few generations of Buddhist teachers in China. As the Han Dynasty declined and as Chinese people began to grope around in that intellectual and religious world, very difficult one actually, and began to look for new ideas that they could use to deal with the difficulties in their lives and the changed circumstances in China as a whole. Now, eventually, in a process that lasted a few centuries, really, Buddhism was no longer perceived by the Chinese as being a foreign religion. It became a full part of Chinese civilization and began to influence China as deeply as the Confucian and Taoist traditions had before. This process was really pretty complicated, and it was split up in China into two separate regions. In the northern part of China, China came under the influence of a lot of barbarian kings who really didn't know very much about Chinese civilization, and there was a great deal of turmoil in Chinese society. Some of these kings found Buddhism an attractive and appealing religious tradition precisely because it gave them a set of values that were not particularly located or associated with any particular Chinese social group or political entity, but also could appeal in some way to the loyalties of their Chinese subjects. Many of the peasants who had been oppressed for many centuries found in Buddhism an appealing way to imagine that there might be some salvation beyond this world. And Chinese intellectuals found in that interesting relationship between Buddhism and Taoism a way for them to explore intellectually a model, an ideal in which they could escape from some of the suffering in this world, but also do it in a way that responded to some of the traditional concerns and interests of Chinese life. So eventually, Buddhism was no longer treated as this odd foreign import, an import from India, but something that really could respond and in an indigenous and natural way to the concerns of Chinese life. In his account of Buddhism during the Tang Dynasty, Arthur Wright said, "By the 8th century, Buddhism was fully and triumphantly established throughout China. Its canons were revered, its spiritual truths unquestioned. It marked and influenced the lives of the humble and the great, and affected every community, large and small, in the empire of the Tang." Now, this happened in a period in Chinese history, known as the Tang Dynasty, of course, lasted from 618 to 907, and corresponds really to, I would say, the high point, the apogee of the development of and influence of Buddhism in Chinese civilization. This lecture will attempt to convey the richness and complexity of Tang Dynasty Buddhism by focusing on three separate areas of Buddhist life. First of all, the schools of Chinese Buddhist philosophy, picking up those Indian traditions that we've talked about before and developing them in very different ways. As a second topic, devotion to the celestial bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, who is known in China as Guanyin, and also devotion to the celestial Buddha, Amitabha, figures that we've seen in India but take on a distinctive character in Chinese Buddhism. And finally, Buddhist influence on Chinese literature, a place where it's possible for us actually to get quite an attractive and accessible understanding of the relationship between Buddhist and Taoist values in China. So, let's start with the first category, the Chinese Buddhist schools, Buddhist philosophical schools. The Tang Dynasty saw the emergence of several indigenous Chinese styles of Buddhist philosophy. One of the earliest and most influential of these was named Tiantai, or Heavenly Terrace, after the mountain where the school was founded. Zhe Yi, who lived from 531 to 597 and was the founder of this school, was concerned about the confusing diversity of Buddhist doctrines. As you might well imagine, you know, here you're sitting in China in the 500s, and somewhere out of Central Asia comes a U-Haul full of Chinese Buddhist literature, and it simply gets dumped in your driveway, and your job is to try to sort out some of the varieties in this incredible tradition. One sutra is giving you an image of ultimate reality that looks like one kind of thing, and another sutra tells you something else. And your job is to try to bring some kind of unity and consistency to this incredibly diverse tradition. Jiri grasped this challenge and really tried to do something serious with it. To resolve the apparent contradictions, he developed a system of classification, associating different teachings with different audiences in different periods in the Buddha's life. So he was saying, essentially, that the Buddha taught one set of teachings to this group who were there with him at a certain phase in his life, and then he moved on to other teachings. And then the question came up, of course, which was the best? What was the final teaching that really represented the teaching of the Buddha and could be used to interpret all of the rest? Jiri thought that he found the most definitive and inclusive doctrine in all the Buddha's teaching in the text that we have already looked at that's called the Lotus Sutra. Now, you remember that this is the sutra that gave us that classic parable of the burning house. It showed how the Mahayana teaching was, as it were, the final teaching of the Buddha, presented to his disciples after they had been taught in a skillful way to enter the Buddhist path by pursuing other vehicles. The story was that a father saw a bunch of his children in a burning house, and he tried to get the kids out, and they refused to come, so he offered them a series of different so-called vehicles, carts, that they could play with when they came out of the house. And when they got out of the house, he didn't actually give them a whole bunch of different vehicles. He gave them only one vehicle, which is the vehicle of the Mahayana, the great vehicle. That was understood in this text as being the definitive teaching of the Buddha, and it was the one that Jiri used to interpret all of the other teachings that were present in this great U-Haul load of texts that had been dumped in his backyard in China. Now, Jiri developed a particular conceptual approach to the doctrine of emptiness that we haven't seen before, at least in quite this way. It's really an interesting one, and it had a tremendous impact on the rest of East Asian civilization. He said that emptiness was to be expressed in the perfect harmony of three levels of truth. I'll tell you what these three levels are. The first one is really the truth of emptiness, that all phenomena, all dharmas, are empty of any intrinsic identity. It's a classic statement of the doctrine of emptiness in the form that we've seen before in our discussion of Indian Buddhism. The second truth is that all phenomena exist dependently. This is called the temporary truth. And then there is the third truth that's called the truth of the mean, that's the truth that all phenomena are both empty and dependent simultaneously. So what he's done here, we think back to the discussion we've had of Buddhist philosophy earlier, is to take the ultimate truth and the conventional truth, discuss them separately. In this case, he's talked about ultimate truth first and then conventional truth, and then insist that there is a final truth, the truth of the mean or the truth of the middle way, that involves the mapping of one of these truths onto another. So what he often does then in his own teaching is to start you out with some kind of a statement of ultimate reality, some statement of emptiness, and then there's some discussion of conventional experience. And then what he does is to try to map the conventional experience and the ultimate experience together into the experience of the mean. This is an abstract concept, and it's hard really to imagine exactly what the influence of this is going to be, but it had tremendous effect aesthetically on the way the Chinese and the Japanese expressed Buddhist insight, especially in their verse. I'll say something more about that in a minute. Jiri also developed a doctrine of 3,000 worlds immanent in an instant of thought. And this idea, too, you can imagine is coming from the Indian tradition. It's not that far removed from some of the things that we saw in the Indian sutras. But how Taoist it feels, you know, to say that what you've got here is all of the cosmos present right now in a single moment of thought. You can see the movement of Jui's mind. It's very down to earth. It's very pragmatic, and it brings the abstractions of Buddhist philosophy right down into a single moment of experience. And that, too, of course, had tremendous aesthetic impact in Chinese Buddhist literature. I'll say more about that, too, when we talk about the literary expression of these ideals. Now, there's a second Buddhist school that also is worth talking about when we catalog for ourselves the philosophical schools of Buddhism in China. It's called the Huayan, or the Flower Garland School. It was founded by a figure named Fatsang, who lived from 643 to 712. You can see his dates also correspond to the dates of the Tang Dynasty. The name of this school came from a corpus of Indian Mahayana sutras known as the Avatamsaka, or the Flower Garland Sutras. So it too was based on Indian texts, but not on the Lotus Sutra, now on another body of Indian sutras. These sutras conveyed a very positive image of emptiness as the mutual interpenetration of all phenomena. So like Jui's teaching about emptiness, teaching of the Huayan had to do with the interpenetration and the positive merging of reality in conventional experience. The doctrine of this school is sometimes called, at least by graduate students in Buddhism, sometimes called the Three Musketeers philosophy, because it pictures the cosmos as all in one and one in all. Really, I don't know how many people even remember that old phrase about the Three Musketeers, but it kind of resonates from my childhood. The old Indian example of this doctrine is the image of Indra's net, which is a network of jewels in which each jewel reflects the light from every other jewel in the net. So if you want to perceive all of reality, all you've got to do is perceive just one single instant in the flow of existence, and reflected in that will be all of reality. It's a very powerful image, again, of the interpenetration of all of reality. It has strong philosophical significance, strong meditative significance, and also strong aesthetic significance in the literature. Another school that I suspect would be more familiar to many of you is a school known as the Chan, or meditation school, a school that gave a very distinctive Chinese interpretation to the practice of meditation. Now, the Chan school is the school that eventually became Zen in Japan. Zen is, of course, a very familiar phenomenon to many of us today in America. It permeates American culture in all sorts of ways. You know about the Zen of flower arranging. You probably also know about the Zen of tennis and the Zen of the stock market. All of this comes, in one way or another, out of the Chan tradition in China. Now, it's sometimes said that the word Zen is a Japanese mispronunciation of a Chinese mispronunciation of a Sanskrit word that means something like meditation. And that's sort of true. Chan comes from a Pali word, jhana, that's related to the Sanskrit word dhyana, that we have encountered. I'm not sure you would remember this, but we encountered it in the name of the meditation Buddhas in the lecture on Tantric Buddhism. A meditation Buddha was a dhyani Buddha, a meditation Buddha. So Chan has to do with dhyana, with meditation. And it is the great meditation school of China. It's traced in China to the career of a legendary Indian saint whose name is Bodhidharma, who flourished, we think, between 460 and 534. So his life came a little bit before the Tang Dynasty. He is represented a lot in Buddhist art, and I've brought with me here to show you a very typical image of Bodhidharma in the Japanese tradition. You can see he's got a little bit of a scowl on his face. He always, in one way or another, looks like kind of a hairy guy, because the Chinese think that Westerners from India and also other places in the West have a little bit more hair on their body than the Chinese themselves picture would be entirely attractive. So he's got a scowl on his face, he's got a funny look in his eye, and he has about 2 days' growth of beard on his chin. And he also, maybe a little bit more remarkably, has no arms and no feet. That's a bit more significant. The story of Bodhidharma is that he sat down in meditation facing a wall for 10 years until his arms and his legs fell off. And that's why he's depicted in Japanese and Chinese art as this person so stably located on the ground, almost like an old Joe Palooka figure who can be knocked down but will always stand himself up. This is Bodhidharma, the founder of the Chan tradition in China. Now, this tradition that came from Bodhidharma began to take on a Chinese character in the hands of Hongzhen, who lived from 601 to 674, and particularly in the hands of his two major disciples, known as Shenshu, who lived from about 605 to 706, and Hui Neng from 638 to 713. Now, these two disciples, as it turns out, at least according to Chan tradition, clashed with one another and developed radically different views of the Dharma. The story of their clash is expressed in a really important Chan text known as the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Patriarch. The sixth patriarch is Hui Neng himself. The story goes something like this. Hui Neng is a barbarian from an outlying region in China and decides that he'd like to pursue the path to nirvana. He'd like to achieve enlightenment, and he hears about this great Chan meditation master and decides to go study with him. He makes the journey to Hongzhen's monastery and presents himself for teaching, and Hongzhen says to him, "Who are you? Why should I teach the Dharma to a barbarian like you?" And Hui Neng, already a fairly assertive young man, it seems, "There is no north and south in the Buddha nature. Why shouldn't I be taught the Dharma?" So the master sends him outside and tells him to do menial labor. He goes out and he pounds rice with the rest of the monks and works as a menial assistant in the monastery. And then the time comes when the master stages a competition to decide who's going to be his chief disciple, who's really going to receive his transmission. In the monastery at this time, there is a man named Shenshu who is sort of the A student in the class. He's the favored disciple and the one who would be the natural successor to the old master. The competition takes this form. He asks everyone in the monastery to write a little verse that expresses their understanding of enlightenment. And Shenshu, being the favored disciple, the A student in the class, pins his own verse on the bulletin board. It expresses enlightenment like this. "The body is the tree of perfect wisdom. The mind is the stand of a bright mirror. At all times, diligently wipe it. Do not allow it to become dusty." Now, if you take a look at this, if you listen to it carefully, you can hear in these words an echo of that old Yogacara vision of the mind that we talked about in our discussion of Buddhist philosophy. The mind here is like a mirror. You also could say, I suppose, that it's like an ocean or a jewel, and it's been covered with dust. That's the experience of samsara and the experience of all of conceptual thought in our ordinary vision of life. What you do in meditation, what you do in Chan, is to try to wipe that mind clean, so that all of those conceptual distinctions and distractions are simply eliminated. It takes a long time, it's a gradual process, but eventually the mind becomes clear and you become enlightened. That's nice, it's perfectly good Buddhism, but you can also slice through all of that if you really make a radical application of the doctrine of emptiness. And that's what Hui Neng did in his response to Shenshu's verse. He put his own verse on the wall. This is what it says. Fundamentally, perfect wisdom has no tree, nor has the bright mirror any stand. Buddha nature is forever clear and pure. Where is there any dust? It's really a strong piece of Dharma combat, you might say. It tops Shenshu's verse and makes a radical application of the doctrine of non-duality. The story, of course, in the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Patriarch, which is Hui Nong's story, is that the master called Hui Nong into his room in secret that night and passed the mantle of his authority on to Hui Nong and then said that he had to leave the monastery and establish his own tradition. And out of this came a split in the Zen tradition between two styles. I can also say the Chan tradition. That's probably more accurate to say here when we're speaking about this tradition in China. The split was between a sudden school, a teaching of sudden enlightenment, that was Hui Nong's school, and a teaching of gradual enlightenment, the teaching of Shenshu. This split continues to this day as an important part of the meditative tradition in China. Now you can see from this story that the Chan tradition's distrust of words, its love of paradox, and its emphasis on direct person-to-person transmission of the teaching has a lot to do with Taoism. It reflects this Taoist influence on the Buddhist tradition in China. So Chan is probably the best place for us to see the fruition of that process that we talked about last time in the last lecture. Taoist values insinuating themselves into the Buddhist imagination and really transforming it from within. Now, I said at the beginning of this lecture that we'd talk about Buddhist philosophy in China, but we'd also talk about some other things, the devotional tradition and also the influence of Buddhist values on Chinese literature. Let's turn to those two topics. The devotional traditions that played such an important part in Indian Buddhism and also in Tibet had great influence during the Tang Dynasty in China as well. One of these traditions is called the Qingtu, or Pure Land School. It was popular not only among the common people, but also, interestingly enough, among the elite. For peasants and villagers, the promise of salvation in Amitabha's land held out a hope for them of some kind of salvation in a future life. And life is always difficult for peasants in China in even the most prosperous time. Amitabha's vision, or the vision of Amitabha's pure land, was an image of some kind of otherworldly salvation that had a tremendous amount of appeal to many people in China. For the elite, interestingly enough, it also offered a type of contemplation that was very different from the austere practice of Chan, in which you really tried to empty the mind of images and empty the mind of concepts. You can see the difference in this meditation in the words of a practitioner of the Pure Land School by the name of Dao Cho, who died in the year 645. He said, suppose a man in an empty and distant place encounters a bandit who, drawing his sword, comes forcefully and directly to kill him. This man runs straight on, looking ahead, and tries to leap across a river to get away from the bandit. So also is the practitioner of Pure Land Buddhism. When he contemplates Amitabha Buddha, he is like the man contemplating the crossing of this river. The thought is continuous. No other thought mingles with it. It's an interesting little spin on Buddhist contemplation. We've talked before about chanting the name of Amitabha Buddha in order to be saved in Amitabha's pure land, but we haven't ever talked about the quality of the contemplation itself. In what way do you need to think about Amitabha Buddha in order to make this crossing of the ocean of samsara? Here, Dao Cho says that you have to, as it were, contemplate the immediacy of Amitabha's salvation in a single, intense, perfectly focused thought. So it becomes a kind of contemplative practice that's very similar to the contemplative practice of Chan. You try to focus in some way on just Amitabha, so that Amitabha fills your imagination and you're assured in some way of then making the transition into that other world that's represented by the Pure Land of this Buddha. So Pure Land Buddhism becomes a contemplative tradition in its own right, in a way that will be interesting for us to explore when we talk about the Pure Land tradition in Japan. And finally, for many people, the cult of bodhisattvas like Avalokiteshvara, or Guanyin, as Avalokiteshvara is known in China, promised not just rebirth in another world, but direct assistance with the concerns of this life. As I think I mentioned earlier in my lectures on the Mahayana tradition, Avalokiteshvara, or Guanyin, came to be pictured as a compassionate mother in China, often holding a child in her arms. And Guanyin is worshipped in China historically and also in China today as really a protector of the family and a deity who is particularly inclined to grant the gift of children. Now, we talked about that before, but when we discussed that in our discussion of Mahayana Buddhism, we hadn't yet seen how important family life was in China. The family really is the center of Chinese values in many respects. So to have a deity like this, a Mahayana deity like Avalokiteshvara or Guanyin, who can bring prosperity to the family, is a powerful, attractive feature in the Buddhist tradition. Now, I also mentioned at the beginning of this lecture that we should take a look at the role of Buddhism in Chinese literature. I'd like to conclude by commenting on a couple of Buddhist poems. The first of these is written by a poet who is known simply as Cold Mountain. Cold Mountain is his name, it's the place where he lives, and it also is his primary symbol of enlightenment. Let me read one of his verses, and you, as you listen to it, should think a little bit about whether this is Buddhist or Taoist, or whether it's some subtle combination of those two traditions where it's difficult any longer to get the two traditions apart. As for me, I delight in the everyday way, amongst mist-wrapped vines and rocky caves. Here in the wilderness, I am completely free, with my friends, the white clouds, idling forever. There are roads, but they do not reach the world. Since I am mindless, who can rouse my thoughts? On a bed of stone, I sit alone in the night, while the round moon climbs up Cold Mountain. I love this poem. I must say, this is one of the things that really makes the Buddhist tradition appealing to me, and it always takes my mind, even in the most complex and confusing situation, right straight to the top of some rocky peak in the Adirondacks, where I'm wrapped in mist and contemplate the flow of the mountains through the valleys. That's the image we have of Cold Mountain. He's a mountain ascetic. He lives in the mountains and he experiences the freedom of the wilderness. Now, really, what we're talking about here is the classic Chinese image of a Taoist sage, Taoist ascetic who withdraws from society to achieve union with nature out there in the wilderness, in the natural world. But you can also see that Buddhist values are very powerfully expressed in this verse as well. When he talks about the way, it's the Buddha way. It's the everyday way that leads you to the experience of enlightenment. The wilderness and the experience of freedom that comes in the wilderness, that's the old experience of Buddhist renunciation when the Buddha left the palace and went off to wander the forest roads with the bands of ascetics. And then at the very end, when he talks about the round moon climbing up Cold Mountain, the cold moon is a classic Indian symbol of the Buddha that cools the passions of life in this world. And the cold mountain we've talked about, of course, is this mountain at the center of the cosmos that symbolizes the experience of enlightenment in the tantric tradition. So all of these images in here, or many of them, are powerfully resonant Buddhist images as well as images that would work just as well in the Taoist tradition. And then let me read one more verse that I think gives a classic example of the way Zhe Yi's philosophy of the three levels of truth expressed itself in literary form. This is a verse by the Buddhist poet Wang Wei. Empty hills, no one in sight. Only the sound of someone talking. Late sunlight enters the deep wood, shining over the green moss again. This is a verse that again takes me to the Adirondacks, walking up an Adirondack trail and hearing the chattering of a bunch of Boy Scouts coming along the trail behind you. In some ways, it's a very simple expression of Buddhist values, but you can also see in it a very subtle mapping of Jiri's vision of the world. Empty hills, no one in sight. That's ultimate truth experienced in the wilderness. Only the sound of someone talking. That's conventional experience. Chatter, jabber, the jabbering of all sorts of words. And then finally, an image at the end of the union between these two, of ultimate reality and conventional reality, and the experience of sunlight shining into the depths of the wood. What is the wood symbolically in Buddhist literature? It's samsara. It's the forest of samsara. And what is the sunlight that floods through this forest? It's really the face of a Buddha like Amitabha. It's the sunlight of the Buddha's wisdom that illuminates us in this world. Now, there's a lot more that could be said about the Buddhism of Tang China, but I hope you've gotten from this just a flavor of the sophistication and complexity of Buddhism when it became fully a part of Chinese civilization.